Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, brought to you by Cyence Technologies. We interview outbound leaders at fast growth businesses to learn their secrets and bring you actionable insights. Thanks for joining us this week.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast. Really excited today to have Tibor Shanto with us today. He is an author, an expert consultant, and just an overall guru in this space that I'm really excited to speak with. I know, Tibor, welcome. And I know you have a history with Eric as well. So, Eric, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background together, and then we can jump right in.
We've done co-marketing on a number of things because, you know, frankly, I've been in the prospecting sales tool space and now on the services side for quite a while now.
We're excited to have you, Tibor. So thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, we just started talking to Tibor actually off camera a moment ago. And after about 30 seconds, we said, you know what? This is all gold. We should get this recorded. So we should probably jump in with what we were just talking about a moment ago, Tibor. And it was, you were mentioning that everything you do is really based around objective-based selling, which is an idea that you've kind of not only formed, but then shaped everything from prospecting to sales process all around. So maybe we could start if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So it came from a couple of things. One, as I mentioned, just you always need to have a differentiator. And if you talk to, you know, with pundits like myself, they always talk about pain and, you know, problems and solutions, right? But I think if you go out to the marketplace, you find, and I think marketing has always understood this, that, you know, people go through various stages, right? So they're, from their point of view, there's awareness, consideration, and decision. But salespeople leave the house thinking everybody's in decision mode. And so what I've come to sort of to look at is, you know, what gets people to buy? And I had an argument with my co-author about whether you can sell to somebody that's in status quo. And his argument was that, no, you can't. And my argument was you can. And we got into this whole big thing as to why that is. So I went out and did some research and found that about 75% of people who leave vendor A to go to vendor B said that they were satisfied or completely satisfied at the time that they switched. So this correlation between loyalty and satisfaction didn't hold. So I started talking to people who left me. I started talking to people who came to me as clients. And the one thing I began to see that the market is segmented. And again, if we use the three from the marketing or sales point of view, you have 10% that's actively out there. They're the ones hitting your website, downloading all the things and really putting themselves into the funnel, that mythical 57% from CEB some years back, right? So that's 10%. So I think, you know, again, those people are either ready to buy or they're using column fodder. They're getting your data to rationalize a decision that they've already made. So you should be able to get through those relatively quick. But there's 20% that's what I call passively looking. Maybe they know that their warehouse lease is coming up in a couple of years, so they'll need to get a new one. Last time it took them 6 months to find the place, so they tack on 3 months for insurance. So they figure they've got about 12 to 15 months in their mind. So they're approachable, but salespeople want to approach them like you want to buy, you want to buy, you want to buy. And their tendency is to say, no, not yet. You know, it's a lot like the dating analogy and you can fill the rest for yourself. But then you have about 70% that, whether it's true or not, is not aware that they could use the product that we sell. But they also switched, right? 75% switched. So I began to ask and came to the conclusion that the one thing that all businesses have in common is objectives. They could be big objectives, small objectives. For the people in pain, yes, the immediate objective is to resolve that pain. But once they've resolved that pain, there's still an ongoing business. So I find that if I can get people to focus on what objectives they can help customers achieve. And by that, I don't mean how their product fits in, but go back 6 months later, a year later, and talk to that customer about how their workflow has changed, how they've, you know, impacted elements of their business from supply chain to customer experience and so on. And it's those outcomes, those objectives that we want to sell. And we have the template for it because customers will talk to us about why they buy from us, why they continue to buy from us. It's just a question of putting it in a context that makes sense to somebody that didn't call you, but you called them. So to me, the if I can identify objectives that customers have, and more importantly, if I can identify things that I've achieved for some customers and I see others in the market who aren't geared on that, then it's a great opportunity to have a conversation that's not about pain. I don't like pain.
Well, pain's hard, right? Because oftentimes pain lives with a direct assertion of whoever the prospect is, you know, being either responsible for that pain or not addressing that pain or it being a gap area. And you know, full frontal with prospecting has never been successful in my observation at virtually anything. But one of the things that you described that was super interesting to me is it sounds to me like you've got a prospecting methodology and formula that is very well suited to playing the probabilities of any type of volume-based outreach.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you can, I liken it, I think we're saying the same thing. I liken it to the to a train. You know, all the buyers are in the front car. And then as you go further and further back, they're less and less closer to buyers. But I figure if I can get on the train and continue to move with them, then eventually they'll become buyers. As salespeople, we should be spending probably more with people who are not yet ready to buy, because that's where we can, that's where we can create awareness, I guess, to borrow the phrase.
I think that's exactly right. And I would also join that concept with the fact that outbound is deliberate. It's direct response. We call our shot. We are not subject to whoever happens to come to us raising their hand, you know, saying, hey, I'm ready to investigate or find fit with your services or product. Because of that deliberate, intentional, considered approach, if your numbers hold, and I have actually complete agreement that those are the right numbers in a you know 100% basis, given that 70% are not in any kind of rush to make any decisions or change the status quo whatsoever. One of the other insights that's really kind of interesting to me, and I'd love for you to unpack it further for our listeners, is entering the discussion around that exact fact. Entering the discussion around, hey, I may be ready to sell to you because I'm a vendor, I'm a seller, but you're not ready to buy from me. So the conversation needs to start with what your current status quo is around your objectives.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. And part of the challenge with that 70% is I have to bring the objective to them. I have to literally dangle it in front of them and say, do you recognize yourself in this? Because clearly they won't recognize themselves in the question, do you want to buy? But if I could dangle an outcome that I've learned from a previous client in front of them, then A, they'll have the sense that I've been to their neighborhood before and it's okay to talk to me, especially if I use that language. And, you know, a couple of humorous things, but I think they land on it. I always say that people don't budget for pain, but they budget for objectives, and they're more likely to spend that money if they budgeted for it. And so what I try and get people to talk about, because it's hard to get them away from pain, is think about what that person was thinking about in the height of traffic on their way to a leadership team meeting. Right. So it's the last Wednesday of the quarter. They got to go in and explain how the quarter went, regardless of which department they're with. What are they thinking about on their way to work? And it's rarely our product, but if I can connect with what they're thinking about and ultimately my product can get them there, then I could lead the discussion by putting certain objectives out there. And if they like the subject, they'll jump in. If not, they'll move on to the next one.
It's funny, nothing starts emotion like thinking about presenting to the leadership team. That's one thing that always seems to get people's attention. So visualizing that is a really interesting tip, especially for the prospectors out there trying to get people's attention. One theme that's really evident when you talk about your strategies and our discussions is feedback loops. You regularly talk about going back after the fact, after you've had a client, after they've left, after they signed up, and surveying them, finding out details, asking them more about why did you come to us? Why did you leave? And it seems like you then incorporate that into the front end of the cycle as well. So can you talk a little bit more about kind of how you create those feedback loops and how far do you go in then following up to gather that information? You know, what do you do with it? What does that whole thing look like?
So I go a fair distance, or at least that's what people say. So I go back and, you know, so this whole objective-based selling, it's all well and good to say objectives, but then you got to break it down. And there's four major areas that I look at, which is risk, finance, productivity, and how can I shift time in their favor, right? So once I know that, then I can begin to understand how I've been able to deliver against objectives that people like that have had. So if I've sold to a marketing person in, say, a software company, then what objectives have I helped those people achieve? And those are the things that I would tend to lead with. So in my prospecting call, and I would say the hardest thing when I work with people is I tend to put the outcomes first. You know, I truly believe, and feel free to push back, but I truly believe that as long as it's legal, moral, and ethical, most business people don't care how you get them there as long as you get them to their destination. But again, I emphasize moral, legal, and ethical. Like, we can't lose sight of that, right? So I think when it comes to a prospecting call, the first thing we have to understand is the dynamics is, you know, as Eric said, we're making the outbound call. So you can bet your bottom line that you're interrupting them. So the first thing you have to deal with is the dynamic that you're a professional interrupter. So once you accept that that's what you do for a living, it makes things a lot easier. But if I'm going to interrupt you, then I have to quickly give you some level of value for that. And that's why I want to stick the outcomes out there. So those things, I literally, if you took my program, I call them value danglers, and I dangle this little cloth that I clean my glasses with, because if that aligns with one of the things that that person was thinking about in traffic, now there's a conversation. Because, you know, it's a lot like Jeopardy, right? And, you know, if you ask most people, you know, if they watch Jeopardy, they'll say, yeah. And then you ask them how you make money, and they'll tell you that you have to answer the question. And that's wrong. They give you the answer. So you can go back to your customers and get the answers. Why do you buy from me? You bought from me for the last 8 years. Why do you do that, right? It's really not a hard conversation to have. And then, like Jeopardy, you got to come up with a question that's going to get that answer on the table, right? So there's a couple of ways to do that. Like, if I'm dealing with somebody that I really don't have any ideas, which is really a problem that I have, not them, I'll ask a simple question. I'll say, Harry, you know, I'm curious, if we were sitting here 18 months from now, and your team, you were telling me that the team had hit a grand slam, what would that look like? And the hardest thing salespeople have at that point is shutting up and letting the person think and talk, right? But what I find is that they literally get engaged. Like, you know, they have those lean in moments, and they look up to the right and they look up to the left, and they tell you all the things that they see as being nirvana in 18 months, right? And then all you have to do, and you know, sales is a bit of theater arts, right? So you have to sort of look back and look considered and very simply say, you know, I get it, Harry, because I know why you want to go there. I've helped other customers get there. Just help me understand why we're not there today. And they'll give you a list of all the stuff that is in the way of nirvana that they just described. So I think, you know, once you begin to do that regularly and talk to people about, you know, where they want to be, then you can get objectives on the table relatively easily. I don't want to say that it's a snap and it's, you know, there's still all the traditional challenges, but I think we're always looking to differentiate, yet we always end up going in and talking about the same thing, right? APIs, integrations, all that stuff, you know, what's it going to do for me is still the oldest question, right?
It so is. You know, I really love that anecdote, because what you've done there is really pulled the abstract future forward into the concrete present. And it's so hard for people to fight the urge to want to talk when somebody asks them about what's important to them, especially in the future. Because then they can like let it rip. They can basically articulate for you all the things that they want to do, all the objectives that they want to achieve.
And there's no barrier in the future. It's not like, it's deliberate. You start off with them, you know, looking into the bright future, and then you sort of bring reality into it. But, you know, but everybody has those objectives. I think the other part of it is to know how different people, like in the same decision, will have different filters, how that will impact their objectives and so forth. I think the expression above my pay scale is something salespeople should be aware of, because often they're trying to get a decision from somebody who can't make it.
So I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of a topic that, you know, is a constant debate around, you know, the halls of science and all of the hundreds of clients that we work with. And that is, when we learn, you know, the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever number objections to the way in which we're professionally interrupting, I'm going to steal that. I love that. And going forward, how much of that should be moved up into the original messaging? into the original, you know, kind of reason to care. Why me? Why now? Why care? In your opinion?
I think it should be moved to the top. As I was saying, like the quicker you can get to the end of the story. So, you know, in school, they always told us not to read the last page of the novel. I want you to give them the last page of the novel, right? And the idea is that if I can put something enticing in front of you based on business outcomes as opposed to, you know, product, then I would imagine that if I hit the mark, not imagine, I've done this, is that they'll ask you how you do that, especially if it's something that they're interested in. You know, we talked about books before, but I think, especially in the enterprise space, I think the next book that any sales leader should buy their people is the 10-Day MBA. That guy should pay me royalties. I mention his book every time. But if you think about it, I think the challenge that a lot of salespeople have is that they don't have that deep of a business background. Most of them are not that curious. And I'm not saying that as a flaw. I'm just saying it's a fact, right? Whereas I think that the best salespeople, and on my best day, I get sales because I give my prospects therapy, right? I allow them to say the things that they've been wanting to say that they just haven't, right? So I think if they had an idea of how a business person processes a business decision, right? And let's face it, most of the people we're going to sell to are probably going to be closer to an MBA than not, then you can have an entirely different conversation. I think the problem that a lot of salespeople that I work with have is that they're not business curious. And as a result, it's easy for them to fall into the talk track of the product. But if you had any amount of curiosity about, you know, how this money thing moves back and forth, you can quickly have a different conversation with your clients, right?
You know, that's really interesting. We had a term that was, coined on one of our previous episodes by one of our other guests, business acumen. And he made a very similar point to what you're saying here is we look for people who have made cold calls before, closed deals before, but very often people in our space don't look for those who have run businesses or been involved in the running of a business, understanding how departments work, understanding how much of a nightmare scaling an organization can be. Those considerations, it becomes very hard to find people who really get them. And it's so important.
Yeah, I think though you can test that in the hiring in some ways, right? But you know, there's a firm here in Toronto that does hiring in an interesting way. They do a week-long simulation, and the thing that they tell me that's interesting is most candidates self-eliminate when they realize the amount of work involved. So you know, the first day they get my word, not theirs, sort of a dossier on the company, and come up with a scenario. Then they have to call into the company and get appointments with the hiring person, and then they have to go through a light, but still a discovery call. So I think that, you know, you could, again, we're assuming enterprise space where there's more on the line, that that's not a bad, even if you didn't hire this firm, but sort of replicated the, and they have an interesting point, you know, American Airlines wouldn't put a pilot into a jet without putting them through a simulator first, right? So.
That said, I think that the prospecting field or SDR craft is generally practiced in real time, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, in the vast majority of cases.
Yeah. And, you know, some organizations do a good job of recording the calls and trying to make sense of it and so on. But I think that's still the minority as opposed to the main.
You know, I have some other questions soon about the enterprise space in general. But before we get there, sure. You mentioned something that I can't leave hanging, which is, you know, you kept talking about these business objectives and especially business objectives that enterprises have. You've had a lot of enterprise clients. You've done enterprise consulting. You've worked with these types of companies for a long time. I think we all know what sellers think the business objectives are. I don't know if those are the same as the business objectives that enterprises actually have, or at least the way that they view them. So are there any patterns or themes that you've noticed in terms of the differences between what sellers and sales developers think are really important business objectives versus what the businesses actually care about?
Yeah, I do this thing where, you know, we try and in the same vein, and it's part of the deal review of what's the biggest goal that you help them achieve. And if you speak, and I love copier salespeople, don't get me wrong, but they're an easy example. But if you speak to copier salespeople, they'll tell you that the biggest issue that the company faces is they're not getting enough colored copies per minute, right? Whereas, you know, they're facing, you know, imports from overseas, they're facing taxes, right? So if they could actually talk to that business person about how they can maybe, you know, I thought UPS had a brilliant set of commercials a few years back when they talked about how their electronic signature allows you to get the invoice out a day early, which means you'll get your money a day earlier, right? So I like that. I use it a lot. It doesn't take me long to extrapolate and say, and it's, so as a result of that, you'll have less dependency on your line of credit, right? So it doesn't take much to take something and dress it up from the business point of view. But a lot of, maybe it's because I run my own business, so I'm sort of conscious about some of these things and so forth. But if they, you know, those are the type of things that business people are trying to figure out. How can I take drag out of the supply chain? So if I can get something somewhere half a day earlier, or it's not eating up warehouse space and all that. And, you know, when you sit them down and lock them up in a room, they eventually get to it. But they all tend to think that the product was designed to do this specific thing. And they can only talk about what it does, not what it leaves behind.
I think the other insight that's buried in what you're saying, especially around objective-based selling, where you're highlighting workflows, is by doing the work, if you will, of talking to your existing customers of why they bought, what changed for them, you know, how their status quo moved, even when, you know, the 75% said they were totally satisfied with that status quo before. One of the important distinctions, and I actually think it's top secret for really good, bright prospectors, is that is some other company that might be a lookalike, their authentic truth. And what's interesting in the prospecting dynamic is it's impossible to argue with somebody else's truth. The only thing that is left for a prospect to decide is, do I want that or not? Does that sound attractive to me or not? Versus asserting, hey, you know what, our ROI with you will be 30%, or we'll do this for you guaranteed, or some kind of sales claim that is less than believable.
I don't know if you saw the study. It came out from Trust Radius a few years back, and it was all about this topic about how customers don't trust the data that vendors share with them. They focus on different criteria. But the one thing that I found fascinating, probably because it supports my point of view, is the fact that they said that what customers are really looking for is other customers' experience, you know, hands-on experience with that. You know, I was talking to Mike Bosworth last week. I don't know if you know him from Solution Selling fame, right? And he was talking about peer envy. And, you know, if you can create that peer envy, you know, then there's reason to talk to you, right?
It's so funny you say that. One of our core training concepts when we teach our SDRs at Science is all the cool kids are doing it. Nobody believes what we're doing, but if we can tell you that all the cool kids are doing it, they might actually latch on to that a little bit more. And everybody has a different way of saying it, but all of the experts seem to be really leaning on that idea that they will trust what the rest of the market's doing way over any of the sellers or sales developers. It's really interesting.
More and more. I mean, every year that seems to be, you know, the case that what we say as not just salespeople, but the whole vendor community is every year discounted a little bit more.
Well, I think that, you know, those of us who have been on the buy side, and I've been CMO for, geez, quite a number of years, a few gray hairs, maybe not as much as some, but on the buy side, I'm always interested in what my fellow brethren, my birds of a feather CMOs are up to, especially in my space, in my category, my industry. You immediately have my curiosity when you start to talk about things that others with my same title are doing.
Yeah. And if that what they're doing is not buying, but what they're achieving or how they're changing elements in their marketplace, then it becomes much more interesting. And I think that's what, you know, again, there's always that tension between marketing and sales, but I think marketing has it right. Like, when somebody is that far away from a decision, help them get to the point where they can make the decision as opposed to trying to ram a decision now when you know it's not going to happen.
Well, and there is no truth so powerful as the one that a person comes to themselves.
Yeah. So if you can lead them there, it's even a better way. If you can lead them to that water, they'll drink on their own. And it's, you know, I mean, some of the old truths still, you know, happen. Like, you can see the turn in their eyes, like when they go from the passenger seat to the driver's seat and all that, when you make them, you know, and we do a whole flow on that. You mentioned Gap, going back to, you know, what were they thinking about in traffic? I'm not comfortable with the fact that most VPs of sales don't leave home thinking that they need to buy a prospecting program. But, you know, what I do ask them once we get past the small talk is, you know, I'll say, I'm curious, Harry, how much of your current revenue comes from existing versus brand new customers, right? And they'll give me a number like 85, 15 or something like that. And I'll go, that's great. So if we looked at your 2021 plan, what was it? And it's always 80, 20. I don't know if it's MBA school or what, right? But with those two questions, which are relatively easy for a VP of sales to answer, and you can come up with similar ones for other functions, you've got a gap on the table. That difference between the 80-20 and the 85-15 is not going back in the bottle. But again, if salespeople would be a bit curious, right away, as soon as they hear that gap, they try and sell into it. All right, I could fix that for you. But I always say that this person has gone home every day and told their significant other that their day was okay, even though they're is this gap between where they are. So you have to really get them. This is where the therapy part comes in. When that gap comes up, I go, that's really interesting. What do you attribute that to? Because I want them to think through, why am I going home every day telling my significant other that things are okay when I'm missing out on my objectives? And, you know, once they tell me what the possibilities are, and the anomalies, once in a public company, I took a VP of sales as far as the value of his options were, if they increase the revenues, right? But that's the anomaly. But then you also, again, because people's propensity will be to go back to center, you also have to ask them how long they can continue doing what they're doing and missing their objectives, and then help them monetize it and so on. But again, I think salespeople are so afraid to let go of their product that, you know, they need both hands to ask the other questions, so they won't do it. But, you know, and I think part of it, and I would attribute this to what's his name, Perinelli, back in his veto, is that if you want to talk to somebody, it doesn't matter who they are, talk to them as a peer, right? So
love that advice. Know, yes. Real quick, so when you're consulting, how do you pry that hand away from the wheel, from especially maybe the SDRs that are opening up a conversation that are totally product focused, which we all know is a dead end street?
We just, you know, it's a lot of gentle love, and as much as you just have to draw the line that, you know, I think listening to the calls, which is important, and then going back and being very tactical. I mean, at the end of the day, as somebody said, you know, prospecting is a skill, which is good because then it could be taught. But as with most skills, it just doesn't get enough practice. That's another thing we spoke about with Mike, is that, you know, we're the only profession that doesn't practice between games, right? Every other one, like, you know, football spends more time practicing between games, baseball, this, that, musicians, you name it. We're the only ones like of that stature that don't practice between games. So, you know, that's how you, if you want them to get away from the old habits, you have to support them. It's like smoking, you know, you have to hold their hand through it, you know?
Well, I love the comment about gentle love too, because we live in a space that everything's about hunting and killing and owning and controlling. And sometimes I think people need to hear that you can take a step back and just be a nice, decent human being, have a conversation with someone, add some curiosity. And often that, especially in this day and age, is more effective than, you know, dominating your way to victory. I think that's really interesting.
I think the underlying thing is, I think people have the sense that you do care about their element of it. I don't think anybody holds it against us as salespeople that we're successful and we want to make money and we have certain, you know, brash elements in our attitude. But, you know, I genuinely want to see my clients sell more, right? And when I worked for my corporate, I generally wanted, you know, my clients to get more out of the product. And, you know, I was as mercenary as the next guy when it came to my quota and this, that, and the other, but I don't think that the two are at odds. I think you can be a very good, assertive salesperson that does well for their company and at the same time does as well for their customers. And I think it again goes back to this business, you know, whether you call it 10-day MBA or acumen. You know, and I think as I'm saying that, the other thing, Eric, maybe is, you know, like, I look at what organizations teach their people, And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the salespeople, if this is what the company wants, that's what I'm going to give them. So if all the company talks is product, then what are you going to talk to your customers about? So I used to do work for this company where the people would come on, and the first week, the only sales training they had was me. Everything else was how to fill out a form, how to enter an order and all that. The average guy there didn't get their first order till about the fourth or fifth month. Imagine if they actually told them how to sell instead of, you know, how to fill out an order form, you know, then they probably would have gotten their order a lot earlier, right? So
forms will get completed if you bring the sales in. Someone will fill out the form. So one other thing I wanted to ask about curiosity, and this is a bit of a segue because we talked about the curiosity side in terms of being curious about your prospects and curious about your clients. But the reason this podcast even exists is there's been a lot more curiosity recently about soft skills and tactics and what actually works. And I think we're in kind of a new age of people starting to try to level up their craft. People, just like buyers, are pushing themselves further down the sales journey. Sellers are starting to listen to podcasts, read books, follow webinars, all, you know, all these different things that you can do. And now the feedback is they're inundated. There's so many of them. There's so many different things they can do. You're an author of multiple books. You run a Monday morning coffee breakfast podcast that I need to start following more. I discovered that in prepping for this interview. And you do a lot of other similar things. There's a lot of different channels you've gotten sales excellence to the people. How are people consuming it in 2021 differently? The best way to reach them? And also, do you have any tips for those who are listening here and trying to figure out where do I best put my time to level up in enterprise sales development?
There's a lot of good sources out there. You know, I'm probably not a good one to ask because I try and sort of keep a lot of it away because, as you say, we are being inundated. But I don't think it's new. You know, if you go back to the last decade where we had, you know, Dan Pink talked about, you know, information parity and things like that. So I think that there's always that element of it. My concern, and maybe it goes to the question you have, is, you know, a lot of the information that's out there in our universe is just a big old echo chamber, right? And, you know, so unfortunately, often it's the loudest voices that win the discussion as opposed to the voices that make most sense. So I think that you have to find one or two people that resonate with you and then, you know, follow on from there. I do look at it a little bit like music, right? Like if you like a certain genre of bands, you're going to look for other bands like that. Things are going to come up and you know, I think your taste continues to evolve and so forth. But, you know, again, I know a lot of the authors out there and so on. And there's a difference between a good sales book that'll give you skills and memoirs of a salesman, you know? So we'll leave it at that.
In the echo chamber, as you see it, no need to name names. What is the worst advice that you keep hearing that drives you nuts?
The worst advice I hear is that value is in the eye of the beholder, you know, and I'm not sure I even buy into the beauty part of it, but, you know, if value is in the eye of the beholder, that means that the goalpost is constantly moving and it's pretty hard to score. You know, I mean, I know it's a cliche, but one of the first things we work on as part of objective-based selling is coming up with an actionable definition for value. Because if you have that, and people can go to my website, it's not a state secret, but if you have that, then, you know, one of the first things I try and do with customers is say, you know, this is the way I look at value. If I achieve this, then I will have delivered value for you. And if I can get them to agree, then my argument is that if I come down to a bake-off between myself and somebody else, I'll have the luxury of having defined what the value is for them and I can bring them back to that. So I think salespeople and pundits, you know, let's call them out, not by name, but as a profession, you know, we take the lazy route at times. You know, yes, it's hard to come up with value and it's hard to get past the noise, but, you know, we get big bucks. It's not like we're working at McDonald's. The average, you know, SDR does quite well if they do their job well, and that's the entry level, right? So, you know, I used to own the domain that sales is a blue collar job because, you know, sometimes you do have to do some lifting and work to get past it. But this stuff about value being in the eye of the beholder, it just drives me crazy.
If it's in the eye of the beholder, it means that that the salesperson or the sales developer didn't do their job right, is what you're basically saying.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think they're talking to the wrong person because, you know, clearly not in the 10%, right? But, you know, one of my pet things is that there's always the opportunity to say that somebody put them up to it, right? Meaning their manager or their sales leader, right? And so I think that that's where that issue has to be resolved, is at that phase. And I think that that's one area that maybe as a profession, you know, we could do more. Like, there's a lot of talk about coaching, and I know I'm not the best coach in the world. I can coach my programs, but I know that I benefited from coaching at critical parts in my career, and I could point to it making a difference. You know, there's a lot of talk about coaching in the business, but I don't think there's a lot of coaching going on.
I think it's probably
robot building.
Pretty fair assessment. You know, the other part that's really tough is how coaches are measuring any of their coachable, teachable moments. You know, how those nuggets are either being brought forward into, you know, the talk tracks of their their students, if we want to use that word.
Yeah. Well, I guess the, you know, for those guys, the results are in the eye of the beholder. Who knows?
Well, that's the ultimate bottom line in business. But I suppose the thing, especially when you're looking to contrast and compare, you know, pre-coaching, post-coaching, that's really where the rubber meets the road, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, I see a lot of organizations talk about coaching, but when I speak to the average manager and I say, you know, do you have a coaching plan for your reps? And it turns out to be not much more than water cooler talk or stuff that they would talk about in the car on the way to a sales call, which is a sales coaching, not coaching for the individual. And so I'm a firm believer that they should have an annual coaching plan for each of their reps. So at the end of every year, their rep is a little bit better and there's a reason to keep them and there's a reason to stay.
How do you balance, you know, obviously your mantra, your slogan is execution, everything else is just talk. So how do you balance executing the actual activities with things like coaching, which is still a type of execution, but things like coaching and leveling up and everything else? On one hand, you want to get as much execution done as possible, but you also have to level up the quality and make sure that the QA is there. So how do you balance the two?
So you're asking from my perspective or in general, how should people do it in their companies?
Well, I would say kind of a mix of the two. When you're working, for example, with enterprise clients and they're struggling with that, you know, do you tell them to focus mostly on coaching and leveling up, and then once they're ready to start making calls? Or to your point earlier, do you tell people, you know, dive in the deep end and that's how you're going to get your practice?
Well, the dive in the deep end is when I'm talking to a customer, right? So when I get on the phone, I respect the fact that I interrupted you, so I'm going to get to what's in it for you right away. When we're developing the reps, you know, I want to make sure I understand the question correctly. Like, I think most of a manager's job should be coaching. I think they should be leading from the front as opposed to behind the dashboard, right? Now, that doesn't mean doing it for them. So I'm not talking bird dogging, but really coaching. So in my plan, we look at areas that Tibor, if he improved, would be a better salesperson. And, you know, you can't have too many because, A, we're people. So as you say, we have to have, you know, time to sell and all that. I think what people aren't good at when it comes to that is structuring their time. So I was introduced to a good method that basically allows me to do quality coaching in about 15 minutes a week. The idea is to have a plan, share that plan, make sure that everybody's on side. And it's the regularity that drives it. It's a lot like, you know, when you start a blog, you know, if you don't keep it regular, people are not going to read it. So I always tell organizations that their coaching plan will fail because of the manager, not because of the frontline rep, because there'll be two or three sessions and all of a sudden the manager will go, I got to go to a leadership meeting. So all of a sudden that's more important than my coaching, right? So you'll get one or two that you'll get away with that. But, you know, so I think part of it is you have to live, you know, you have to sort of be the demo. You have to demonstrate the life. So structure it in a way that, you know, if you have 12 reps and you did 15, 20 minutes with each a week, it's not that much. And what else are you going to do? I really do think that a manager's job is to be an active frontline leader. So if you're not coaching, what are you doing? Like, it's not like we have to do reports because the systems will do it for us, right? And, you know,
So are we asking for inside information to, for a brief summary of, you mentioned 15 minutes and you can coach somebody up. I don't want to steal all your secret sauce, but is there any clues you can give us to that?
No, I don't think there's a secret sauce. Again, I came to it by the way I was sort of brought up through the system. I think the key thing is to really do it about execution. So I know it's stating the obvious, but it can't be about the way you feel about a person and so on. It has to be about how they're going to do something. Now, sometimes the challenge is the person's personality, but still, you know, it has to be about things that they can enact. I also think that the biggest opportunity is to do everything around the process, right? So I'm going to coach Harry and I'm going to coach Eric on how to execute our company's process. So now it's no longer about what Harry's doing wrong or right. It's what can we do together to help you execute the process. Part of that is, you know the metrics, right? Because if we can talk about the metrics, we can talk about the underlying activities that will change those metrics, right? So to me, that if you structure your time, you put that coaching in, and you do one-on-ones every week, I think, you know, people tell me that they can't, you know, the excuse that you said that there's not enough time. Well, it's been shown over and over that if you did 15 minutes a week, you'll get more than that time back from in terms of dividends and so forth. So I think people sometimes expect these big, exciting things, but, you know, sometimes it's the mundane, small things done right that will make the biggest differences. And, you know, people think they come to sales and it's exciting. It is if you make it, but sometimes it's boring and coaching is necessary, but boring. You
know? We have a saying at Science where it's really all about getting 1% better every day. Yeah. And the compounding effects of getting 1% better are actually huge, astronomical when you actually do the math. It's crazy.
I was just going to say to those out there listening who are thinking, oh my God, how am I going to go get 8 hours a day of coaching into my schedule? How am I going to manage all my people? You don't have to boil the ocean. And I think that's what Tibor is telling you is 15 minutes a day. If you can do more, great. But small baby steps will actually make major impacts. And hopefully that's a relief to some of the people who are panicking, thinking, oh my God, I have to add coaching to my calendar now.
And I think they do. Like, there's no getting away from it. Seriously, if you have 10 reps, 15 minutes per, right, a week, that's 150 minutes. What is that? Less than 3 hours, right? Still leaves you 40 some odd hours in the week. You know, you can still get your football pool done and all that, right? So, you know, it's, I am, you know, sort of serious about that, that what else is a frontline manager going to do, right? So if not that. I think the other is that coaching has to be in context of everything else. So I'm not a big fan of pipeline reviews because I think they're somewhat transparent. They're always there for the manager and they're always done 2 days before he or she has to go to the director, right? But I am a big believer, again, if you want to talk about active coaching, in doing pipeline previews. So I'm more interested in sitting down with my team and asking them to talk to me about things they're going to see this week, people they're going to see this week. So it implies that they're going to see people, which is a good thing. And they have a next step and they actually know why they're going. And if I'm not quite convinced that they have everything down pat, I can coach them in a positive way by asking a few questions that'll get them on track. So I'm a big believer in pipeline previews, and you don't have to look at every single. If you looked at my pipeline, I'm not going to execute this thing differently than I will that thing because it's me, right? So I think the other is there's a disproportionate amount of time wasted on stuff that's not going to get you anywhere. And one of them is pipeline reviews. Now, if you talk to me about four opportunities that you're going to see this week, I'll have a pretty good idea of A, what shape your pipeline's in, where I can help you close those things as opposed to talking about it next week and talking about why it didn't go the way I wanted it to go. So if I can look at your activities in advance and do the preview and align them with my longer term coaching, it's, you know, it's in action. It's not theoretical. It's actually unfolding.
That's awesome. It's what you said earlier. It's leading from the front rather than cracking the whip after the fact. It's going in and saying, we're going to tackle this together. I'm going to give you the support you need and we're going to get it done. So I can only assume the reps respond very well to that type of management rather than why didn't you close this deal after the fact. The last question that I wanted to ask you about, I did want to circle back to that podcast. And I was really just curious, almost in a selfish way, of how it's going. You know, again, there are so many different types of content. And it was interesting to see kind of a Monday morning breakfast podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I'm sure some of our listeners will probably want to go join you for that as well.
Yeah, that would be good. So it started off as an experiment. When COVID hit last year, you know, I happened to be at the right moment at the right place, and somebody ticked me off like on the first day of like back on March 11th, because it was like, woe is me, the sky is falling. And I said, what kind of BS is this? You know, as we're always walking around saying in turmoil, there's opportunity. Well, there's nothing but turmoil now. So why are we, you know? So I kept doing these daily videos. And then when we got to around your Memorial Day, I sort of wanted to switch things up. So I did a week's worth of things called Breakfast for Champions. And I invited on, you know, a couple of people, you know, that you may or may not know. I'm trying to remember, but the names escape me at the moment. So when I decided to do something again and looking to be different, I didn't want to do yet another podcast, even though that's where I ended up. But so I decided to do this Breakfast for Champions on Friday mornings. And, you know, tongue in cheek, I always say, you know, our goal is to have you out of here by 8:30 so you can make money by 9. And then I realized that there were two limitations to that. One is I was cutting off some guests early and we weren't getting to the juicy stuff. And the other is not everybody's up at 8 o'clock on a Friday morning Eastern time, right? So I decided to go with, I take the audio version. And what I've been able to do with most of my guests is they stay on after the live portion is over. And that allows me to tell the podcast people that they're getting some extra, I call it overtime. But it was really the podcast itself, the audio just was a trail end of the video one. And I think I must have been one of those days where I heard, you know, Bill Burr's Thursday morning, the day before Friday, Monday morning podcast. So I said, I'm going to go with that.
Yeah. What's the juiciest nugget that you've gotten thus far?
From whom? From
anyone that you recall that you said, wow, that's good. I'm stealing that. Or that changes my way of thinking.
It wasn't, you know, it's interesting because a quick story, you know, I told you I had Mike Bosworth on, and one of my claims to fame, oddly enough, because tomorrow's the anniversary, is I signed Xerox for a 6-figure deal on 9/11 of all days, right? So, you know, nobody had planned that it would take place the same day. It just so happened that we had planned to all meet in Rochester. And you know, but all that summer I'd been reading Mike Bosworth's book, Solution Selling, right? And I remember going to Connecticut and, you know, my director or VP at the time or whatever kept saying, why are you doing it that way? Why are you? I said, I'm reading this great book, dude. It's like, you know, it's like a roadmap to how we're going to win this deal, right? And he kept jabbing me and all that. So it was interesting when I was talking to Mike last week, he and I had met before through the CEB and stuff, but when we were talking, and I told him this, that he clearly had an influence on the way that I sell, but it was refreshing to see how the ideas that he had back in the 90s or early part of last decade are still relevant, and that he was able to sort of bring them into current phase without losing any of the underlying stuff. So for me, being that I'm not in the mainstream, not, you know, sell a little bit differently, it was good to know that some of that stuff is still relevant, and, you know, taking those bruises is worthwhile, you know.
But yeah, the tactics change, but the strategies don't. It's all, people are still people, and it's all just about, you know, adapting to a changing world. But at the end of the day, the themes, you know, I still read sales books that are 30, 40 years old, and a lot of times you ignore certain little things that have changed, but for the most part, the themes are the same.
You know, I think the one thing that hasn't changed, you know, if you look at sales sort of as being three concentric circles, right? And there's all this talk about change, change, change. Well, on the outside, I mean, what, there's 4,000 apps now on the App Exchange. So there's always something new. And you can sort of see why people would think that there's a tremendous amount of change in sales. And you get that next circle, which is where the two camps sort of interact, right? So marketers have and salespeople have their tools, and then the buyers have their tools to filter it out and all that. But the one thing that I don't think has changed since, you know, even the serpent is why. The middle circle is the why. Why does somebody go to their keyboard and put in a search? Or why does somebody decide to do something on-premise versus the cloud or anything like that? And if you can get to the why of why people are doing it, which is a lot easier than learning the product, right? But it goes back to this curiosity. I find that, you know, I'm not a social guy, even though I was on that social list. At a party, I'm the guy in the corner, right? But But I realized that if I'm going to make money in sales, you have to talk to people and ask questions because, you know, the more you ask, the more you know, and the more they buy.
Simon Sinek would be proud. Start with why. I think he would definitely agree with you.
I was sort of pissed when I discovered him because I thought I had an original idea and then just part of a tribe.
No such thing these days anymore. Only new perspectives on old ones. Well, listen, this has been fantastic, Tibor. It's been really entertaining and just a very natural conversation. So really want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
With the few minutes that we have left, want to give you a chance to shout out. You know, we did mention your podcast, but you're also an author and you run a heck of a consulting group, if that's how you even define it. So would love to give you a chance to shout out what you do and tell our people where they can find out more if it's a fit.
So the easiest place is LinkedIn, right? And, you know, TiborChanto.com. I think if you had to sum up what I do is I help companies take their strategy to execution. And I focus primarily on the front end of the pipeline. So, you know, for prospecting discovery, I'm your guy. If it comes to account management, I'm not your guy. And I tend to do well in industries that the industry as a whole is not growing at the level that the individual constituents want to grow. So the only way they're going to grow is by winning competitive business, but you want to do that without resorting to price. So, you know, if you look, I do well in the wireless, you know, transport, trade, copy, because again, you don't want to go in this downward spiral, which a lot of industries have. That's who I do well with. But TiborChanto.com or LinkedIn is the best place. And, you know, feel free to reach out.
We'll make sure we get your links in the podcast release when we get it out there. So again, thank you so much for joining us. I think there were a lot of really golden nuggets in here that our people will enjoy. And have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too as well. And I look forward to having you guys on.
You betcha. Thanks, Tibor.